The Gathering Storm in America, a play by Thomas N. Mills, adapted for audio by Mara Pearl.
My name is Mercy Otis Warren. I would like to be your guide into the past. I am of the generation that lived, fought, and survived the American Revolution. My desire is to share that story. Not of gods or mythical creatures. It is rather a story of human beings, like yourself, your friends, and your family. It is a story of how a very simple but revolutionary thought grew into a conflict that changed the known history of mankind. The thought was, all men are created equal. The conflict arose when a misguided king turned tyrant, broke his covenant with his subjects, and attempted to devour and destroy instead of defend and cherish. As human beings, we were duty-bound to exercise our natural power, throw off our allegiance, and resist. Storms take place in the lives of men, just as they occur in the heavens above. There are storms of nature, there are storms of the heart, storms of the mind, and storms of providence. All of America, from the first emigrants to my present generation, felt an attachment to the inhabitants of England. We held them in high regard and had a reverence for their laws and government. But this affection was not always returned. Newspapers from England were circulated as soon as the ships arrived in the Bay Colony. We always looked forward to news from home. In one article from the London Chronicle, the author wrote, quote, "New England was settled by Presbyterians and Independents, who took shelter there from the persecutions of Archbishop Laud in 1620. They still retain their original character. They generally hate the Church of England. They came out with a leveling spirit, and they retain it. They cannot bear to think that one man should be rich and another poor. This equality produces also a rusticity of manners, for in their language, dress, and in all their behavior, they are more boorish than anything you ever saw in England. England has produced sharp, acute men, fit for war or learning, whereas the colonists are remarkably simple or silly and blunder eternally. We have 6,000 of their militia, which the general would willingly exchange for 2,000 regulars. They are forever marring our plans. They can, some of them, at least range into the woods, but 300 Indians with their yell will throw 3,000 of them into a panic, so much so that they will shoot one another. Our regulars are afraid to be on command with them on that very account. The most substantial men of most of the provinces are children or grandchildren of those who came here at the king's expense, that is, thieves, highwaymen, and robbers." Unquote. In 1760, we received news that the war with the French was, at long last, coming to a close. Regardless of the common prejudice against us, we were happy to serve England in this contest known as the French and Indian War in America. In 1760, King George III ascended to the throne of England. He was preceded by his grandfather, King George II, who was of the royal house of Hanover, spoke no English, and preferred to rule England from his homeland, which was Germany. In his royal opinion, no chef in England could cook, no English horses were fit to ride, and no English woman knew how to dress herself. Due to the king's frequent physical absence, The British Parliament dominated the affairs of England and its colonies. The American colonists were cheered with the hope and promise of their new king. Sadly, hope and promise were not forthcoming. King George III's coronation sparked the beginning of a gathering storm. James Otis, my dearest brother Jem, and I were tutored in our home at the Marshes, our family farm near Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Our tutor was Reverend Jonathan Russell. He taught us the scriptures, literature, and mathematics. He also instilled in us a great love of history and the law. At the age of 15, Jem was admitted to Harvard University. Afterwards, he spent 2 years studying for his master's degree. He was devoted to his books, yet he always found time to guide my studies. We were both inspired by the writings of John Locke and his theories on enlightened government. Since absolute monarchs ruled all of Europe, we thought ourselves fortunate to be the subjects of the English crown. When James was home, there was always much laughter and gaiety. Sometimes, when friends came to call, he'd play his violin and we'd all dance. Then he would stop suddenly, and we'd have to chase him. If we could catch him, he'd play us another dance. Obtaining his degree, James went off to Boston to study law with Jeremiah Gridley, the Attorney General of the province. After 2 years of poring over and delving into British law, Jem began his own practice. Shortly thereafter, he received an appointment to the Crown Office of Advocate General in Boston, to which an ample salary was attached. In this position, it was his duty to support the petition of the Custom House officers in upholding writs of assistance. These were blank search warrants intended to crack down on duties that were to be paid on the importation of foreign goods. When the revenue officers came to James with a request to defend the writs, he refused to do so. He resigned his office and joined the merchants who sought his services as counsel to uphold their rights against the writs, without a fee. James went on to challenge writs of assistance in front of a panel of judges headed by Chief Justice Thomas Hutchinson. Jeremiah Gridley, Jem's esteemed teacher, was appointed to defend the writs. The courtroom was filled to overflowing.
I was solicited to argue for this cause as Advocate General. Instead, I renounced that office and now argue against the writs of assistance in favor of British liberty. We have heard that the greatest monarch on earth has declared that he glories in the name of Britain, and that the privileges of his people are dearer to him than the most valuable prerogatives of his crown. Therefore, I must challenge the kind of power that, in former periods of history, cost one King of England his head and another his throne. One of the most essential branches of English liberty is the freedom of one's house. A man's house is his castle. These writs of assistance, if they should be declared legal, would totally annihilate this freedom. Customs officers may enter our houses whenever they please, and we are commanded to permit their entry. Customs officers may enter, break locks, bars, and everything in their way, and whether they act through malice or revenge, no court can inquire. Mere suspicion is sufficient. I will, to my dying day, oppose all such instruments of slavery on one hand, and villainy on the other. These writs are a dangerous instrument of arbitrary power. They are destructive to both English liberty and to the fundamental principles of English law.
Our young friend, John Adams, was witness to this electrifying presentation. He said, Otis was a flame of fire, with his depth of research, a rapid summary of his historical events and dates, and a rapid torrent of impetuous eloquence, he hurried away, all before him. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away as I did, ready to take arms against writs of assistance. The seeds of liberty were then and there sown. From this day forward, James emerged as a major advocate and foremost defender of English liberties in the colonies of America. When Governor Francis Bernard took steps to approve funds for increasing appropriations for the colony of Massachusetts without knowledge of the House of Representatives, and paying for them without their consent, it did not go unnoticed. My brother James Otis was quick to respond.
Justice to ourselves and to our constituents obliges us to object to the method of changing establishments made by the General Court. It is, in effect, taking from the House their most cherished privilege, the right of originating all taxes. It is, in short, annihilating one branch of the legislature. And when once the representatives of the people give up this privilege, the government will very soon become tyrannical.
When the governor sent a message vindicating his conduct, James wrote a pamphlet giving an account of these occurrences and justifying the course taken by the House. This became the original resource from which all subsequent arguments against arbitrary taxation were derived. Quote, "The rights of the colonies asserted and proved," unquote, was widely read in Massachusetts, and parts of it were reprinted in newspapers throughout the colonies and abroad. In 1763, the Treaty of Paris is signed, ending the French and Indian War. Benjamin Franklin praised the treaty.
"It was a glorious peace, the most advantageous to Great Britain, in my opinion, of any in our history. Canada and the eastern half of Louisiana are ours, along with Florida and the land between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi, including the Ohio Valley. Throughout the continent, I find it universally approved and applauded. The glory of Britain was never higher than at present. But I fear something relating to America as part of a program of raising money to pay for the war. The Board of Trade for the colonies has proposed a change in the duty of sugar and molasses imported into America from non-British sources. A moderate duty on foreign molasses may be collected, but if they lay such duties as may destroy our trade with the foreign colonies, I think they will greatly hurt their own interests as well as ours. I'm not much alarmed about their schemes of raising money on us, but they should take care, for their own sakes, not to lay greater burdens on us than we can bear. The more you take from us, the less we can lay out for you."
Soon, another voice was heard, this time from the frontier. It was the voice of Pontiac, a leader of the Ottawa people, who spoke strongly against all European and American influences. During the spring and summer of 1763, Pontiac's forces swept through the region of the Ohio and Great Lakes, capturing British forts and besieging British garrisons. The British commander for North America was General Geoffrey Amherst, who, upon hearing that Franklin, an expert on Indian affairs, was in New York, summoned him for an interview.
"Dr. Franklin, what, in your opinion, is the source of all this trouble?"
"I am told that you have eliminated gifts to the Indians."
"Yes, we must cut costs. The war has been a costly one."
"Presents represent a chain of friendship. To eliminate these gifts is a hostile act. The Indians are disgusted that so little notice has been taken of them. The plan of preventing war among them and bringing them to live by agriculture, they resent as an attempt to make women of them, as they phrase it, being the business of women only to cultivate the ground, Their men are all warriors.
Ignoring Amherst's part in the uprising, Parliament concluded that Pontiac's rebellion was a result of greed on the part of the Scotch and Irish settlers on the frontier. Without further investigation, they issued the Proclamation Act that prohibited any settlement west of the Alleghenies. Then, they expanded the British Army in North America to 7,500 men and stationed them in a long chain of western forts. The cost of paying and feeding the soldiers would amount to £320,000 a year. The Americans, they said, should pay the cost. Major changes were taking place in England that were now being felt in America. Unhappily, both for Great Britain and America, George III was nurtured in the inflated ideas of kingly power. Surrounded by flatterers and dependents, this misguided sovereign became dazzled with the acquisition of empire. In the morning of youth and in the zenith of national prosperity, he appeared more obstinate than cruel, and more weak than wicked. The first alarm was news of the Sugar Act that enforced a duty on foreign molasses. The importation of sugar and molasses was connected with the prosperity of New England. For years, the colonies in the north had traded our fish, which the English didn't want, for French molasses that was cheaper than English molasses. The molasses was distilled into rum in New England for home consumption and for trade. This was our means for making payment to England for the imported goods that we purchased and she manufactured. The Sugar Act would enact revenue from the colonies to pay for the costs of the war. James once more appealed.
No parts of His Majesty's dominions can be taxed without their consent. Every part, including the American colonies, has a right to be represented in Parliament.
Orders for the strict execution of the Sugar Act were published along with news of an impending Stamp Act. Dr. Franklin and other agents from the colonies met with Mr. Grenville, His Majesty's Prime Minister, in London.
The late war has left us more than 140 million in debt. It is my duty to make use of every just means of improving the public revenue. I'm not set upon this stamp tax. If the Americans dislike it and prefer any other method of raising money themselves, I shall be content.
Mr. Grenville told those of us who were agents of the colonies that he took no pleasure in giving the Americans so much uneasiness. But considering the whole of the circumstances of the mother country and the colonies, he thought that the colonies could and should pay something, and that he knew of no better way than by imposing such a tax, unless the colonies could agree to some measure of taxing themselves.
Upon this occasion, James addressed the Massachusetts General Court.
We are extremely obliged to Mr. Grenville for his kind expressions of regard to the colonies. But the kind offer of suspending this stamp duty in the manner and upon the condition mentioned amounts to no more than this: that if the colonies will not tax themselves as they may be directed, the Parliament will tax them. Mr. Grenville asserts that revenue must be raised in His Majesty's dominions in America for defraying the expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the same. This colony has defended itself for more than 100 years. It is grievous to be forced to pay for the support of His Majesty's troops in times of peace. Can it be possible that the duties to be imposed and the taxes to be levied shall be imposed without the voice or consent of one American in Parliament? If we are not represented, we are slaves. At this rate, the British colonies will be in a worse condition than those of any other prince, for besides maintaining internal provincial governments among ourselves, we must pay towards the support of the national, civil, and military government in Great Britain. No people on earth are doubly taxed for the purpose of government.
customs officers were ordered to enforce every regulation set by the Board of Trade. And the officers of the Navy were employed in the same service on the coast, so that their war vessels were converted into custom house tenders. Those accused of smuggling were to be tried in a court of admiralty without benefit of a jury.
The rights of all British subjects were forged into the English Constitution as fundamental laws, by way of the old Saxon laws, the Magna Carta, and the confirmation of them by Parliament. Our ancestors, as British subjects, were entitled to all of those rights by the Constitution, as well as by the law of nature, and by our provincial charter. Can there be any liberty where property is taken away without consent? Can it be said, with any truth or justice, that the American colonies are represented in Parliament? Has this entire continent of near 3,000 miles in length the election of one member to the House of Commons? I can see no reason to doubt that the imposition of taxes in the colonies of America is absolutely irreconcilable with the rights of the colonists as British subjects and men. I say men, for in a state of nature, no man can take my property from me without my consent. If he does, he deprives me of my liberty and makes me a slave. The very act of taxing those who are not represented is depriving them of one of their most essential rights as freemen. We think ourselves happy under Great Britain. We love, esteem, and revere our mother country and adore our king. It may be relied upon that British America will never prove undutiful until driven to it as the last fatal resort against parliamentary oppression, which will make the wisest mad and the weakest strong. American representation in Parliament would provide a beneficial union of these colonies to the realm, so that all the parts of the empire may be reconciled and consolidated. The English Constitution will then flourish with new vigor, and our national strength, power, and importance will shine with a greater splendor than has ever been witnessed by the sons of men.
When news arrived that the Stamp Act had been approved, the reactions were explosive, not only in Massachusetts, but in all of the colonies. Patrick Henry addressed the House of Burgesses in Virginia.
As Englishmen, Americans have the right to be taxed by none but their own representatives. As Englishmen, they must resist this encroachment on their rights. Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III...
Treason!
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 And George III may profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it.
The Virginia resolves, initiated by Patrick Henry, were soon to be circulated throughout the colonies.
The Virginia Assembly has the only, sole, and exclusive right and power to tax Virginians. Any effort to vest this right and power elsewhere has a manifest tendency to destroy British as well as American freedom.
Dr. Franklin, you are now, from letter to letter, to suppose each may be the last that you will receive from your old friend. The flame of rebellion has got to a high pitch amongst the Americans. A sort of frenzy or madness has got hold of the people of all ranks. I fancy some lives will be lost before this fire's put out. I'm told my house shall be pulled down and stamps burnt, to which I give no other answer that I will defend my house at the risk of my life. John Hughes, Philadelphia.
The situation was brought home in a more personal sense in a letter from Franklin's wife, Deborah.
Dear Ben, Cousin Davenport came and told me that more than 20 people had told him it was his duty to be with me. Towards night, I said he should fetch a gun or two, as we had none. I sent to ask my brother to come and bring his gun, so we made one room into a magazine. I said, when I was advised to remove, that I was very sure you had done nothing to hurt anybody. I was sure that I had not given offense to any person. But if anyone came to disturb me, I would show proper resentment. Your determined wife, Deborah.
In Boston, an effigy representing Mr. Oliver, the appointed stamp collector, was hung on the Liberty Tree. Chief Justice Hutchinson, Oliver's brother-in-law, directed the sheriff to remove it, but his deputies declined the task. In the evening, the figures were taken down and carried in procession through the streets to a small building on State Street, which Mr. Oliver had erected for a stamp office. This was entirely demolished. Then the procession moved to Fort Hill, where his house was situated. Some of Mr. Oliver's friends were very obnoxious to this ill will, and this provoked an attack. Windows were broken, and some injury was done to the house and furniture. The next day, Mr. Oliver announced that he had declined the office of stamp distributor. Later, a mob assembled on State Street and made an attack on the houses of Mr. Story and Mr. Halliwell, two of the officers connected with the customs. They entered these houses, breaking the windows and destroying the furniture. At the house of Mr. Halliwell, they entered the cellar, and the liquors they found there inflamed them to madness. In this state, they proceeded to the house of Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson, which they completely destroyed. James was mortified by the conduct of the mob. Worse, he was being associated with inflaming this lawless rabble. A stop was put to our commerce. Our courts of justice were shut up. Our harbors were filled with vessels, yet none dared move. The governor would not clear them out, for if they set sail, the men of war would seize them for want of papers agreeable to the laws of trade. During this period of suspense, apprehension, and anxiety, James proposed a general congress of delegates from the several provinces. Thus originated the first congress ever convened in America by the united voice of the people, in order to justify their claims to the rights of Englishmen and the privileges of the British Constitution. Governor Barnard addressed the situation in a letter to England.
By this you may guess what a state this government is in, and is not likely to mend till the power and authority of Great Britain come to our relief. For this I can quote a great politician of this town who is now at New York. James Otis has contributed more than any one man whatever to bring us into this state of outlawry and confusion. We have no force to oppose this mob.
At this important crisis, the delegates appointed from several of the colonies met at New York to oppose the Stamp Act. They composed a respectful petition to Parliament, listing their constitutional rights and their concerns. The petition was received by Parliament with a mixed response. Charles Townsend, Member of Parliament.
Will these Americans, children planted by our care, nourished up by our indulgence until they are grown to a degree of strength and opulence, and protected by our arms, will they grudge to contribute their might to relieve us from the heavy weight of that burden which we lie under?
Member of Parliament Isaac Barr responded,
They planted by your care? No, sir, they were not. Your oppressions planted them in America. They fled from your tyranny to an uncultivated and inhospitable country where they exposed themselves to all the hardships of which human nature is liable. And yet, inspired by principles of English liberty, they met all hardships with pleasure, compared with those they suffered in their own country from the hands of those who should have been their friends. They nourished by your indulgence? No, sir, they were not! As soon as you began to care about him, that care was exercised by sending persons to rule over him, who were perhaps the deputies of deputies to some members of this house, sent to spy upon their liberty, to misrepresent their actions, and to prey upon him, men whose behavior on many occasions has caused the blood of those sons of liberty to boil within him. They protected by your arms, how can this be said, when they have nobly taken up arms in your defense?
Believe me, and remember that this day I told you so. That same spirit of freedom which inspired these people at first will accompany them still. Prudence forbids me to explain myself further. God knows I do not speak other than from the genuine sentiments of my mind.
When we read about Isaac Barr's celebrated defense of the colonies in Parliament, the Patriots began to call themselves the Sons of Liberty. With so much of Jem's time now taken up in politics, there was little left for his law practice, which was his main source of income. He was considered a radical, and he had become an embarrassment to his wife's family. He never complained, but I know he was under a great deal of pressure at home, and he was often criticized by the press.
If the fractious demagogues who lead the mob were caught and hanged, all would be well.
This country must soon be engaged in contests that will require neither the tongue nor the pen of a lawyer. If we are to be slaves, the living have only to envy the dead, for without liberty, I desire not to exist.
Upon passage of the Sugar Act came calls for an embargo against British imports. With the Stamp Act uniting opposition to parliamentary taxation, concentrated non-importation took hold. Only then did British merchants petition Parliament for a repeal of the Stamp Act. The point of empire was profit, and without sales there would be no profits. As commerce plummeted in England, Dr. Franklin was summoned to Parliament. They were now ready to hear the American point of view.
What taxes do the Americans pay of their own levying?
Many and very heavy taxes. In Pennsylvania, there are taxes on all estates, real and personal, a poll tax, a tax on all offices, professions, trades, and businesses according to their profits. There is an excise on all wine, rum, and other spirits, and a duty of £10 per head on all slaves that are imported.
What is the feasibility of distributing the stamps in the American colonies?
The posts go only along the seacoasts. They do not, except in a few instances, go back into the country. And if they did, sending the stamps by post would occasion an expense of postage amounting in many cases to much more than the stamps themselves.
Can the colonies afford to pay the stamp duty?
As it must be paid in hard money, in my opinion, there is not gold and silver enough in the colonies to pay the stamp duty for 1 year.
Should the colonies pay no part in maintaining the British Army and Navy that protects them?
The colonies have essentially defended themselves during the last war, raising 25,000 soldiers and spending millions of pounds.
But has not Parliament reimbursed the colonies for their expense?
We were only reimbursed for what, in your opinion, we had advanced beyond our proportion, or beyond what might reasonably be expected from us. And that was a very small part of what we spent.
What was the temper of the Americans towards Great Britain before 1763?
The best in the world. They submitted willingly to the government of the crown and paid in all their courts obedience to acts of Parliament. Numerous as the people are in the several old provinces, they cost you nothing in forts, citadels, garrisons, or armies to keep them in subjection. They were governed by this country at the expense only of a little pen, ink, and paper. They were led by a thread.
And what is the temper of the Americans now?
Very much altered.
In what light has the Americans formerly viewed Parliament?
As the great safeguard and security of their liberties and privileges. Arbitrary ministers may overstep, but as a body, Parliament could always be counted on to redress grievances.
And did the Americans retain their respect for Parliament?
No, it is greatly lessened.
Have the Americans formally objected to Parliament's authority on these subjects?
I never heard of any objection to the right to regulate commerce. But a right to lay internal taxes was never lawful to be in Parliament because we are not represented here.
A tax is a tax. What is the difference?
The difference is very great. An external tax is a tax laid on imported goods. That tax is added to the cost of the goods. And when they are offered for sale, it is part of the price. If the people do not like the price, they refuse it. They are not obliged to pay it. But the Stamp Act is an internal tax that says the American colonies shall have no commerce, make no exchange of property, neither purchase nor grant nor recover debts, without paying for stamps authorizing them to do so. Nor shall we marry, nor make our wills, unless we pay for stamps. Thus it is intended to take our gold and silver from us, or ruin us by the consequences of refusing to pay.
Could anything less than military force be applied to compel the Americans to accept stamps?
I do not see how a military force can be applied for that purpose.
Why not?
Suppose a military force is sent to America. They will find no one in arms. What are they then to do? They cannot force a man to take stamps who chooses to do without them. They will not find a rebellion, but they could very well cause one.
William Pitt, Lord Chatham, was one of the great parliamentary voices for the colonies.
This kingdom has no right to lay an internal tax upon the colonies. They are the subjects of this kingdom, equally entitled as ourselves to all the natural rights of mankind and the peculiar privileges of Englishmen. Some have the idea that the colonies are virtually represented in this house. I would beg to know by whom an American is represented here. The legislative assemblies in America have always been in possession of their constitutional right of giving and granting their own money. At the same time, this kingdom, as the supreme governing power, has always bound the colonies by her laws and by her regulations. There have been made restrictions in trade, in navigation, in manufactures, in everything except that of taking money out of their pockets without their consent.
I beg to differ, sir.
Lord Grenville?
Great Britain protects America, and America is bound to obedience. The colonies have been asked to pay an expense arising from themselves. In return, they renounce your authority, insult your officers, and break out into open rebellion. The seditious spirit of the colonies owes its birth to the quarreling in this house.
Lord Grenville tells us America is obstinate. I rejoice that America has resisted. 3 million people so dead to all the feelings of liberty as to voluntarily submit to be slaves would be fit instruments to make slaves of the rest. Lord Grenville has made much of the debt the colonies owed the mother country as a consequence of the late war. The profits to Great Britain from the trade of the colonies at £2 million per year is the sum that carried England successfully through the war. You owe this to America. This is the price that America pays you for protection. England has the power to crush America to atoms. But she will pay a heavy price if she tried it. America, if she fell, would fall like the strong man. She would embrace the pillars of the state and pull down the Constitution with her. The Americans have not acted in all things with prudence and temper. But they have been wronged. They have been driven to madness by injustice. Will you punish them for a madness that you yourselves have caused? Let prudence and temper come first from this side. America will follow the example. Upon the whole, I beg leave to tell the House what is really my opinion. It is that the Stamp Act must be repealed. Absolutely, totally, and immediately. I yield the floor to Lord Camden.
Thank you, sir. I fully support your proposal. This position is founded on the laws of nature. Nay, more. It is itself an eternal law of nature. For whatever is a man's property is absolutely his own. No man has a right to take it from him without his consent, either expressed by himself or through his representative. Whoever attempts to do it attempts an injury. Whoever does it commits a robbery.
Dr. Franklin, would the Americans be satisfied with the repeal of the Stamp Act if it were accompanied by a declaratory act stating the right of Parliament to tax the colonies?
I think that stating the right of Parliament to tax will give them very little concern, but only if it is never attempted to be carried into practice.
When news of the repeal of the Stamp Act reached the colonies, there were bonfires, illuminations, celebrations, and the giving of thanks. Patriot homes were brightly illuminated with candles on the eve of celebration. Jem's home, which faced Boston Common, was open to receive the thanks and well wishes of the people who had come into the city to see a spectacular display of fireworks.
In 1719, the English Parliament issued a declaratory act that gave them the right to legislate for Ireland in all cases whatsoever. Well, 5 years later, upon a visit to Ireland, I was amazed by how totally crushed the country was by the ruthless application of English power. The appearances of general and extreme poverty among the lower classes were appalling. They lived in wretched hovels of mud and straw. They were clothed in rags and subsisted chiefly on potatoes. Our New England farmers of the poorest sort are princes when compared to them.
In June of 1767, the Townshend Acts were passed that put a tax on articles imported from England of the greatest necessity. This was to be an external tax on British imports like paint, glass, lead, cards, paper, tea, and a long list of other items.
Along with these new acts, we received word that governors and other crown officials will not only be appointed, they will be paid by the crown. Such a power under a corrupt administration could introduce an absolute rule of government in America.
It is very uncertain as yet what turn American affairs will take here. The friends of both countries wish reconciliation. The enemies endeavor to widen the breach. God knows how it will end.
On the 10th day of June, 1767, the Liberty, a vessel belonging to Mr. John Hancock, was seized by the commissioners of the customs in a very violent and insulting manner. The British man of war, Romney, had plowed into Boston Harbor for the purpose of impressing American seamen into the Royal Navy. Taking advantage of the Romney's presence, customs officials confiscated Hancock's ship on suspicion that it contained smuggled goods. Several barges from the Romney took possession of Hancock's Liberty and anchored it under cover of its guns. The people considered this act as designed to mortify the chief merchant and one of the most distinguished patriots of the town. A mob assembled, assaulted some of the customs officers, and burnt the collector's boat. The next day, the customs officers retired to Castle William in the harbor, declaring that they did not consider their lives safe in the town. James presided over a town meeting that was held to draw up an accurate statement of the occurrences and transmit it to the agent in England to prevent misrepresentation from being listened to by the ministry. The governor's council passed resolutions censuring the customs officers. Nevertheless, Governor Bernard confirmed that he had requested the king's troops to be sent to Boston to protect the customs officers.
The raising and keeping of a standing army during times of peace, without our consent, is an infringement of our natural constitutional and charter rights. Employing the army for enforcing laws made without the consent of the people or the representatives is unconstitutional.
As the governor had declared himself unable to call a general court in the present emergency, they voted that the town should meet with the committees of other towns in a convention to be held at Faneuil Hall. It was agreed that the citizens should arm themselves for the defense of the community. The regiments, with several vessels of war sent to protect a handful of customs officers, arrived on October 1, 1768. The ships were stationed in a position as if to blockade the town. The American War may be dated from the hostile parade that took place on this day. It was viewed by a vast crowd of spectators who beheld the troops marching sword in hand through the principal streets of Boston. The absurd and inconsistent statements of Governor Bernard were that the whole country was on the eve of a rebellion. Yet there was no actual opposition shown, except for the sullen countenance of the citizens upon the arrival of the troops called upon by this incompetent and blundering minister. The troops were lodged in the town hall, in Faneuil Hall, and on the common. When the superior court met at the town house in the council chamber, the main guard was opposite. Cannons were planted before the building, and a body of troops was quartered in the representatives' chamber. The house had previously voted a petition to the king for the removal of Sir Francis Bernard from the government. The long list of accusations against him was founded in part on letters he had written to the ministry. The copies we had obtained unmasked him. But the governor had already received notice from London.
Gentlemen, I think it proper to inform you that His Majesty has been pleased by his will and pleasure that I return to Great Britain to lay before him the state of the province. I will continue in the office of governor, and in my absence one half of the salary of the office will be paid to the lieutenant governor. I desire you, therefore, to proceed to grant my salary before attending to any other business.
We are bound in duty at all times, and we do, more especially at this time, cheerfully bow to the lawful command of our sovereign. It is a particular satisfaction to us that His Majesty has been pleased to order a true state of this province to be laid before him. We have abundant reason to be assured that when His Majesty shall be fully acquainted with the great and alarming grievances that his loyal subjects here have suffered through your administration and the injuries they have sustained, he will, in his great clemency and justice, frown upon and forever remove from his trust all those who, by wickedly misinforming his ministers, have attempted to deceive even His Majesty himself. Your Excellency is best acquainted with the part you have acted. Your official letters have enabled this house and the public to form a judgment. And while you will necessarily be employed in setting your own conduct in the most favorable light before His Majesty, we are persuaded we shall be able to answer for our constituents and ourselves to the satisfaction of our sovereign whenever we shall be called to it. With respect to your salary, the people of the province have never failed in their duty to make ample support for the government. You will be paid fully until the time you embark for Great Britain.
Governor Bernard soon afterwards returned to England. Jem's opposition to the administration was so bold, and his contempt for those who were bringing ruin upon the country was so open, that secret communications had long been sent to England to render him offensive to the ministry, and to persuade them to arrest and try him for treason. Copies of several letters of Governor Bernard and of the commissioners were filled with insinuations. Even charges of a treasonable nature were found at the public offices in England and transmitted to James. There was no doubt that these persons had gone much further in their private correspondence. James was stung to the point of madness by the discovery of this secret treachery. Agitated as he was by the actual and impending evils that threatened the whole country, and that were more especially directed against his own province and his own town, these attempts to destroy his character, if not his life, excited his anger to a fury. In defending the cause of the colonies, Jem had looked forward to the time when justice would be done, and where he might derive some honor for all his exertions and sacrifices. James felt proud of his rank in society, and while opposing the ministerial schemes, he still felt loyalty towards the sovereign and affection for England. He longed for the period when he might give proofs of both. But at this time, he found that the crown officers had been laboring to blast his reputation and were attempting to have him torn from his home to undergo persecution, imprisonment, and even execution in the mother country. With proofs of their conduct, he could no longer restrain his indignation and rage.
By this notice in the Boston Gazette, I have full evidence that John Robinson, customs officer and others so named, have frequently and lately treated the characters of all true North Americans in a manner that is not to be endured. They have privately and publicly represented us as traitors and rebels, and without the least provocation, represented me by name as being hostile to the rights of the crown and rebellious to His Majesty, to whom I bear true and faithful allegiance. Satisfaction, therefore, is personally demanded.
At about 7 o'clock, James went to the British Coffee House, where John Robinson was sitting with a number of Army, Navy, and Revenue officers. Immediately an altercation took place. Robinson struck Jem with his cane, and great confusion ensued. The lights were extinguished, and James was surrounded by the adherents of Robinson, who were armed with swords and bludgeons. A young man by the name of Gridley, passing by, very boldly entered the coffee house to give James assistance against so many foes, but he was assaulted, beaten, and turned out. After some time, Robinson and the other assassins retreated by a back passage and took refuge on board one of the king's ships, which lay in the harbor. James, with a deep gash on the top of his head, was left for dead. Although the wound did not prove fatal, the results were tenfold worse than death. The usefulness of this distinguished friend of his country was destroyed. His reason was shaken from its throne. His genius was obscured. And the great man, in ruins, lived several years for his friends to weep over. He was, after a partial recovery, aware of his inability to exercise the talents that had shone with such previous luster, and often invoked the messenger of death to give him a sudden release from a life that had become burdensome. In one of those intervals of beclouded reason, he forgave the murderous thugs that had beaten him, after the principal ruffian had asked for pardon in a court of justice. John Robinson was adjudged to pay £5,000 sterling in damages. But James, despising all compensation, relinquished it on the culprit's asking pardon, and setting his signature to a very humble acknowledgment of wrongdoing. James returned to Barnstable, the home of our childhood, where even in his wildest moods of that insanity with which he was afflicted, it was possible for me to calm him. Often he would say,
"I hope when God Almighty in his providence shall take me out of time into eternity, it will be by a flash of lightning."
On the 23rd of May, 1783, only a few months before the British left our shores forever, a thundercloud such as the season brings in New England passed over where James was staying at a friend's home in Andover. James stood against the door, telling those who had assembled in the living room a story. Suddenly, there was a crash of thunder. Then lightning, serpent-like, darted from heaven to earth and passed through James's body. Instantly, he was dead. I received condolences from our friend, John Adams.
"It was, madam, with very afflicting sentiments I learned of the death of Mr. Otis, my worthy master. Extraordinary in death as he was in life, he has left a character that will never die while the memory of the American Revolution remains, whose foundation he laid with an energy and with those masterly abilities which no other man possessed. I solemnly say, I have never known a man whose love of his country was more ardent and sincere, never one who suffered so much, never one whose services were so important and essential to the cause of his country as those of James Otis."
On May the 23rd, my dearest brother James, my beloved Jem, his wish fulfilled, lay dead. But his cause was very much alive. From the standing army in Boston in 1768, many other events followed that further estranged the American colonies from their mother country. The Virginia Resolves affirms that Virginia would not be taxed without her consent. The Boston Massacre occurs as a mob harasses British soldiers on guard at the Customs House in Boston. The British East India Company is given authorization to sell a surplus of 500,000 pounds of tea directly to colonial agents, bypassing and underselling American merchants. The Boston Tea Party occurs on December 16, 1773, when colonial activists disguise themselves as Mohawk Indians, board the ships, and dump 342 containers of tea into the harbor. Parliament issues the Coercive Acts, called the Intolerable Acts by the colonists. The British Port Bill shuts down all shipping. General Thomas Gage, commander of the British military forces in the colonies, arrives in Boston. He replaces Governor Hutchinson and puts Massachusetts under military rule. The First Continental Congress meets in Philadelphia with 56 delegates representing every colony except Georgia. Attendants include George Washington, Patrick Henry, John Hancock, and Sam Adams. The Continental Congress declares its opposition to the Coercive Acts and promotes the formation of local militia units. A Declaration of Resolves proclaims the rights of the colonists, including the right to life, liberty, and property. The First Continental Congress boycotts all English imports, including the further importation of slaves, and places an embargo on all exports from the colonies to Great Britain. It was as James had predicted.
"This country must soon be engaged in contests that will require neither the tongue nor the pen of a lawyer. If we are to be slaves, the living have only to envy the dead. For without liberty, I desire not to exist.
As if by the hand of Providence, we were delivered to a point of choice between slavery and separation. Of the events that followed, George III declared, "Blows must decide." From our childhood lessons, I recall the words of Reverend Russell. Quote, "Above all else, I pray that you shall remember the laws of God and the laws of England. For as night follows day, there will come another time and another storm, and it will be a true blessing to remember." Unquote. May you rest in peace, Jem. You did not forget. With all God's blessings, Mercy Otis Warren.
The Gathering Storm in America is a play by Thomas N. Mills and introduces a trilogy of plays featuring the history of the American Revolution. Featured in the cast were Abbott Alexander as Isaac Barr, James Horan as William Pitt, and Patrick Henry. Holger Mankata as James Otis, Donald O'Sullivan as Governor Francis Bernard, Eleanor Owen as Deborah Franklin, Tim Byron Owen as John Adams and Lord Camden, Christopher Lowell as Benjamin Franklin, and Mara Pearl as Mercy Otis Warren. Original music composed and performed by Marilyn Harris and Mark Wolfram. Engineered by Bill Bercuda at After Hours Recording Company. Produced by Mara Pearl, executive producers Thomas and Beverly Mills for Heritage Publications. For more information about Heritage Publications, American Revolutionary War plays, audio productions, and teaching materials, please visit AmericanHeritagePublications.com. This has been a production of Haven Books Audio.